Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Carter Worth, Dan Nathan, Guy Adami, and Julie Beal. We've got breaking news at this hour. Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's right-hand man and the former vice chairman of Berkshire Hathaway, has passed away at the age of 99. He was just over a month away from turning 100 years old. Our Becky Quick looks back at Munger's long life and his under-recognized role in helping Warren Buffett become one of the richest people on earth.
Charlie Munger was best known as Warren Buffett's right-hand man, their investing partnership dating back decades.
I would say that every time I'm with Charlie, I'll get at least some new slant on an idea that causes me to rethink certain things. And we've had we've had so much fun in the partnership over the years.
It's been almost hilarious. It's been so much fun.
Buffett credits the Berkshire Hathaway vice chairman with teaching him the importance of paying up for high-quality businesses.
When he weaned me away from the idea of buying very so-so companies at very cheap prices, knowing that there was some small profit in, and looking for really wonderful businesses that we could buy at fair prices.
It's not that much fun to buy a business where you really hope this sucker liquidates before it goes broke.
The willingness to pay for quality paid off for Munger and Buffett in deals like their 1972 purchase of See's Candies and their decision in the late 1980s to buy a substantial stake in Coca-Cola. Before his Berkshire days, Munger owned his own successful investment firm and practiced law. In 1962, he and a group of attorneys founded Munger Tolles, now known as Munger Tolles & Olson, a very prominent law firm. Munger, like Buffett, grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and as teenagers, they both worked at Buffett's grandfather's grocery store, but not at the same time, as Munger was 7 years older. It wasn't until Buffett was in his late 20s and Munger was in his mid-30s and living in California that they were introduced to each other by mutual friends.
We had dinner together in 1959. In 5 minutes, Charlie was rolling on the floor laughing at his own jokes, and I do the same thing.
They began to spend hours each week on the telephone, talking investments, and Buffett urged Munger to trade in a career in law for one in investing.
I met Charlie, and he was practicing law, and I told him that was okay as a hobby, but it was a lousy business.
I listened.
From 1962 until 1975, Munger's investment partnership produced a 19.8% compound annual return versus just 5% for the Dow. It wasn't until 1978 that Munger formally joined Berkshire as vice chairman. But Munger's even-tempered, risk-averse, and pragmatic approach to investing was a major influence on Buffett from the time they first met, helping Berkshire Hathaway grow into a multi-billion-dollar conglomerate that owns well-known businesses like Dairy Queen, Geico, Helzberg Diamonds, and Burlington Northern. Munger, however, didn't limit himself to just Berkshire. He was chairman of Wesco Financial from 1984 until 2011, when it was totally assimilated into Berkshire. During those years, he was known for his deadpan humor and straight-shooting style at shareholder meetings where he interacted at length with his investors. After Wesco, Munger moved the show and his growing collection of fans to another company where he remained chairman, the Daily Journal.
Charlie?
Yeah.
One of my favorite lines from you is you want to hire the guy with the IQ of 130 that thinks it's 120, and the guy with an IQ of 150 who thinks it's 170 will just kill you.
You must be thinking about Elon Musk.
He brought his blistering one-liners to Berkshire Hathaway's annual meetings, too.
What I needed to get ahead was to compete against idiots. And luckily, there's a large supply. And professional traders that go into trading cryptocurrencies, it's just disgusting. It's like somebody else is trading turds and you decide I can't be left out.
Charlie's big on lowering expectations.
Absolutely. That's the way I got married. My wife lowered her expectations.
And despite a net worth of around $2 billion, for Munger, money wasn't everything.
All you succeed in doing in your life is to get early rich from passive holding of little bits of paper. And you get better and better at only that for all your life. It's a failed life. Life is more than being shrewd at passive wealth accumulation.
Well, with that, we're through.
Becky Quick joins us now. Becky, you knew Charlie better than anybody at this network, covered Berkshire Hathaway for so long. We all knew Charlie for his wit, his Mungerism, so to speak. But I think the interplay between Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger is really fascinating, the friendship, but also sort of the give and take and how Charlie was the true foil to Warren Buffett in terms of bouncing investment ideas. I remember Warren Buffett called Charlie the abominable no man.
Yes.
That really captured it all.
Yeah, kind of saying no to Warren when nobody else could or would, saying this doesn't work and here's why. Look, they did figure out together a different thought of investing, a different way of building things. Warren Buffett had been an acolyte of kind of this idea before, Ben Graham's ideas, that you go around looking for cigar butts and you can get a few more smokes out of the last few drags on that cigar butt, buying good businesses, decent businesses at really cheap prices. Charlie Munger is the one who kind of changed Warren Buffett's thinkings on these things, where he said we should be buying great businesses at decent prices. You don't have to go so low and just get a great bargain price for it if you have a great business that will eventually take care of itself. Buffett has been very outspoken about how Charlie shaped him and all of those things. Today, Warren Buffett putting out a statement saying Berkshire Hathaway could not have been built to its present status without Charlie's inspiration, wisdom, and participation. And just a couple of weeks ago when I sat down with Charlie, he did talk a little bit about how things started at Berkshire Hathaway. Here's what he had to say.
But I did not really think that we'd ever have one. It would, so many hundreds of billions in Berkshire. I did not anticipate when Warren and I were starting with our little piddly start that we'd ever get to 100 billion, much less several hundred billion. It was an amazing occurrence.
What happened that you didn't anticipate? What led to that success?
Well, we got a little less crazy than most people, and a little less stupid than most people, and that really helped us. Then in addition, we were given this much longer time to run than most people because something kept us alive in our 90s, and that gave us a long track from our little fiddling start all the way to the 90s. Those are the two things that really happened. And of course, we wised up over time. We got into better and better companies, and we understood more and more of the bad things that could happen to you and how easy they could creep in. And we avoided them even more assiduously when we were old than we did when we were young. And it all worked.
I think back in 2015, for the 50th anniversary of Berkshire, you wrote in the shareholders' letter that, among many other things, you had a $60 billion pile of cash at that point. You thought that pile of cash would decline over time because you'd be able to buy more and more things. Now you've got almost $160 billion in cash. Is there an opportunity for a really big purchase with that? And do you think you'll see one?
Well, of course, there's an opportunity for a purchase a lot bigger than people can make who don't have $160. We have $160 billion in cash, plus a great credit rating we deserve. And who in the hell has that? Not very many. Yes, but what it's going to be, I can't tell you. It can't be anything too small, because it doesn't matter how good it is. We're of a size now, or too small just doesn't move the needle very much. So we haven't need something big to come along and use up all our cash and some borrowing. But who's more likely to find something? The guy who has $160 billion in cash, plus a long history of buying bargains. I don't think it's hopeless. It may have to be done by some different people. You know, the next time we may not be able just to squeeze a little more lemon juice out of the old lemons. We may be able to, we may have to squeeze some new lemons, meaning new people may have to make the decisions. But who can make them better than somebody that has watched the early process all through all those years and seen how well it works, and who starts with a little legacy of $160 million of cash?
So you're talking about Greg Abel, Ajit Jain.
Yes. And he,
Ted and Todd.
Or somebody not yet identified.
Melissa, that was just 2 weeks ago today, and Charlie Munger at 99 years and 11 months, really still had great command of everything that he saw, very quick mentally, very capable of sitting and kind of reflecting on all of these things. But he's a huge reason why Berkshire Hathaway is the company that it is today, and he will be sorely missed.
Are there investments that Berkshire Hathaway has held or has currently that has Charlie Munger's fingerprints all over it?
Sure. I mean, probably BYD is the biggest example of that. They got in very early, and that was something that Charlie Munger was very excited about because of the guy who was running the company. There were a couple of trips to China, one with Warren and Charlie both. Traveling to China to see their investment there. And I think they were both kind of blown away by what they saw. But Costco at different times. But BYD is probably the biggest example of that.
Right. All right. Becky, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Becky Quick on Charlie Munger. Very sad news tonight to digest. He was a larger-than-life force in the investment scene guy.
Yeah. No, it's incredible. You know, you want to say to Becky, I'm sorry for your loss, because how close she is right. with Mr. Munger and Mr. Buffett clearly over these years. I mean, that's more than a friendship. I mean, that's a long relationship that they've had. I'm sure it's an emotional night for Becky. But in terms of the loss for the community, you learn a lot of things. I mean, I'm sure this show sort of flew in the face of everything they believed in. And I'm sure it's sometimes if they had it on, they would sort of wince. But the genius of what they do, just understanding good businesses and the power of investing and staying with something, I don't think any of us should forget that.
He's also been a critic of bad corporate governance practices, calling companies out. He's called, investing in cryptocurrency, gambling and drag. He doesn't beat around the bush when it comes to so many topics.
No. I mean, the Costco thing is interesting because Munger was on the board in 97 and Buffett bought in 98, and he held it all the way through until it spiked post-COVID, and they sold their Costco position in 2020 after it's, and it still is right now at that relative high, has not made a new high relative.
Yeah, it's interesting what Guy just said, though. You know, like fast money, and again, there's investment styles for all sorts of people. And I think that, you know, if you are a trader and the like, you learn lessons from people like Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett. We've been listening to Becky. As long as I've been in the business, I feel like I've been listening to her on a quarterly basis, interview those. And every single one of those interviews, I've taken something away that's helped me think about the markets.
Right. Julie.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, us at Kane, we're long-term quality investors, so a lot of Charlie's ethos is very much in ours. And what I appreciate so much about him is the humility he took to investing. He never tried to make it fancy. He never tried to exclude people from understanding it, like we're such brilliant people up on the mountaintop declaring what is important and what's good. He really made it accessible. And I think that was his genius in creating simplicity and understanding fundamentals. And so he'll be very missed.
We're looking at this footage of the annual meeting, which is so widely attended. Mm. So many people want to go to meet. It was almost like meeting rock stars here. But these were average investors for the most part who invested in Berkshire Hathaway because they believed in the investing ethos that Julie had outlined. So it's amazing to think that, you know, even before the age of a fast money or so on, he opened up this annual meeting to legions of investors who then learned from them.
Groundbreaking, without question. And it's interesting, in the last clip that we watched, Becky's interview, she mentioned $160 billion of cash. I think it's 157. But what's interesting about that is, I mean, that's a record amount of cash that they currently have. And the bears, like myself, will say that's because maybe they look at the climate and say there's nothing worth. And the flip side of the coin is, and you heard Mr. Munger speak to it, we're just waiting for the right size deal to come along. And it has to be something will move the needle.
And think about maybe the most incredible of all. In the financial crisis, there was one person left. Goldman Sachs turned to him, mm-hmm. and everyone said, if he gets my stamp of approval, we're okay. It was the only thing left.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Only thing.
Yep. Let's now bring in value investor Whitney Tilson, who attended the last 26 Berkshire Hathaway meetings. He's a longtime Charlie Munger follower. Whitney, great to have you with us. Thanks for bringing your perspective on Charlie. I know you've known him for a long time, and you're part of poor Charlie's almanac, because Munger is so known for so many of these Mungerisms. What are your favorites? What really sticks with you?
Yeah, well, I've been listening with interest to all the comments from the folks there about what a legendary investor Charlie is. And that's how I first discovered him, when I started my little hedge fund back in the late 1990s, discovered Buffett and Munger, been going to all the Berkshire meetings since then. And then Charlie would have his own Wesco and more recently Daily Journal annual meetings, you know, a couple weeks afterward, usually. And it was like, it's sort of like a church, and you've got the Pope, and that's Warren Buffett, and then you've got the senior cardinal, Munger. And what I quickly discovered is that I was getting a lot more from both of these wise old gentlemen in areas outside of investing. And that's what I think, you know, once people discover these guys, most people discover them because they're trying to make money. They're investing their own money, or they're in the investment business. But let me give you an example. I remember more than 20 years ago sitting there at the Wesco annual meeting, and Munger, in response to some question, said, "All I want to know is where I'm going to die, so I never go there." And everybody laughed. And he said, "No, I'm serious." He said, "Once you've reached a certain position in life that basically all of you in the audience have reached, a certain level of education and financial security, your main focus in life should be not to screw it up." So he always talked about invert, always invert. So he said most people, the way they think and approach life is, you know, how can I reach for that brass ring and reach another level of success, right? And what he said is instead, once you've reached a certain point pretty early in your life, your main goal should be how not to screw it up. And so he gave many of his famous speeches, like the 24 causes of human misjudgment. He was always telling stories of how people who had it all brought themselves to ruin. And that really made a big impact on my life. And so after being one of the contributors, here's a copy of Poor Charlie's Almanac, which, by the way, is the first thing I would recommend anyone read if they want to understand Charlie. I was one of the contributors to this book because I was so obsessive. That it was one of the great honors of my life, writing this book that's a tribute to him.
It's amazing how much he has contributed to, you know, things and subjects outside of investing, Whitney. But I'm curious, as an investor, what did you take away from Munger? Were there investments that you were led specifically to by Munger, or Munger's thinking, at least when you're thinking about going in?
Yeah, well, I wish I had followed him more closely. I sort of followed the first part because he was very clear thinking about investing in high quality businesses, even if you have to pay a little up for it going in. And that led me to some of the greatest investments in my career in companies like Apple and McDonald's and Home Depot and all. Where I didn't control myself as well as I should have is I should still own those stocks today. Thanks to Charlie's teachings, I identified some of the greatest businesses of all time and owned them for a while. But, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, I wish I'd had more of Munger's patience and owned them, you know, for a lifetime, because that's what he and Buffett have done with their most successful investments.
Whitney, you've dedicated, it's interesting, I mean, you're a disciple, clearly, you've had a great career, but, you know, I listened to Mr. Munger talk about, you know, giving back, and Mr. Buffett as well. You've done that as well. And my sense is, you know, a lot of things you've done on the continent of Africa maybe been inspired by the teachings of Mr. Buffett and Mr. Munger. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, both of them are very generous and philanthropic and are giving their fortunes away to their charities. But interestingly, both of them mostly spent their time on what they felt they were uniquely good at, which was investing and compounding their money over time. I've probably spent a greater percentage of my time, traveling to Africa, supporting Ukraine over the past year, et cetera, just because it's something I'm very passionate about. But I tip my hat to these gentlemen for being laser focused on what they were uniquely good at and building enormous fortunes that are going to make a big difference to millions of people for generations.
Whitney, you've discussed like how much you've learned from it. About investing from them over the last couple of decades, and you've seen them do it over, very different market cycles. Have there ever been any big surprises? Have you ever seen their mettle be tested in a way that surprised you?
Well, I do remember back in the early days during the internet bubble when Berkshire stock hit a multi-year low in March 10th. The day the NASDAQ peaked in March of 2000 was the day Berkshire Hathaway bottomed. And I remember the annual meeting right around that time, is about a month or two later. And everyone was questioning, how they could have missed this. And they didn't care one iota. They were just so comfortable in their own skins. They knew it was a bubble, and it just didn't bother them. And that's happened again and again. They have, more recently, both of them have been super vocal about the dangers of cryptocurrencies, just pure instruments of speculation, and have warned people away from it. And, there the story's still out. Bitcoin's at what, $37,000 these days. So I'm pretty confident, though, that they will be vindicated on this, just as they've been vindicated on all of their other big calls over the years.
Can there be, I don't want to ask this in this way, but can there be another Charlie Munger in, an investor who spans the generations, who has that sort of following, who can speak out so honestly about so many different topics in such a blunt manner? It just doesn't feel like the environment can produce anyone like a Charlie Munger anymore.
Yeah, I hear you. Like, I'm struggling to think of, other than Buffett himself, who's 7 years younger and hopefully has, many more years to live. They're both cut from the same mold. But after that, boy, it's hard to think. Munger was really, really one of a kind. I don't think there'll ever be anyone who could ever replace him, or anyone who will be quite like him.
Whitney, thank you. Good to see
you.
My
pleasure.
Whitney Tilson. Julie Beal, what do you take from Munger in how you invest? You're talking about how the investment style is probably more similar than the investment style of any of these traders here on this desk to Charlie Munger's.
I talk to clients a lot about how, the real value that I add is when I say no, it's not when I say yes. And I think it's very much in line with always wanting to be extremely discerning and not just being attracted to something because it's a little shiny or it's a little cheap. And it's hard sometimes because you'll think there's a real opportunity and you're so smart for wising it up and finding it out. But often the situations are pretty simple and straightforward. You need to understand your businesses and you need to say no. You need to be extremely discerning and not just go for something that's a kind of quick flip, because chances are someone knows something a little bit more than you do. So I think for me, it's just being very discerning and focusing on quality. And sometimes that's very hard because quality won't be sexy. It'll be out of favor, just like that time period in the NASDAQ. There are definitely periods where at Kane we lag because we don't have the sexiest companies. But they're really great businesses. And over a cycle, if you can have the discipline and the character to just sit still, sit on your hands and not just trade to, create value or make yourself feel like you're so important, you really end up better if off for the long term.
All right, we got to take a quick break. Again, the news here, Charlie Munger, dead at age 99. Back right after this.
Wouldn't it be great to have all your investment and retirement accounts in one place? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, makes it easy. I use it to put my investment account and 401k accounts into one hub and get expert tips that help me confidently manage my money. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They're the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Welcome back to Fast Money. The GLD ETF rising by more than a percent today, and now at its highest level since May. It is up more than 9% over the past 2 months alone, while the S&P 500 is up close to 6% in that period. In a couple minutes, we'll hear from one market watcher who says gold's rise could fuel a risk-on rally into the new year. But before we get to that, let's ask here on the desk, can stocks and gold really keep moving higher together? Guy?
It's interesting, and Carter clearly has thoughts, but one of his theses for a while was rates would go lower, and at a certain point, stocks would follow. If rates continue to go lower, the dollar will go lower. That will be a tailwind for gold. I think stocks will then subsequently go lower as well. So, yes, there's clearly a scenario where both can happen. I just don't think it's probable. And I think gold's within a whisper of having a huge breakout to the upside.
What do you think gold is telling us, Dan?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Whitney just mentioned Bitcoin, also touched 40,000 today. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it seems like there is an appetite for sort of safe haven sort of things. They're buying treasuries, they're buying gold, and they're buying Bitcoin, and they're selling dollars. And I agree with the guy. I think eventually they're going to get to stocks, and they're going to think they're a little expensive.
All right, Carter, we'll get to your 2 cents on gold in a minute, but you put a note out this morning on bonds.
Yeah. Well, so think oil was stretched at 95 a barrel. Dollar was straight up. Yields were straight up at 5. And guess what's happened? Oil has collapsed. The dollar has collapsed. Yields have collapsed. And ultimately, of course, I do believe that this equities will go that way. But let's look at some yield charts. We have three. They're identical. And the first is we know that we have now sold in terms of bonds have rallied. Rates have dropped from 5 to where we are now at 4.3, and I think ultimately going to 4 and below. But look at the next iteration. There is an unfilled gap. It's esoteric chart theory, but it comes into play at 4.195, which is to say that was right after Labor Day. It was a Tuesday, and what happened was the bond market lurched at the open, yield surged, bonds sold off, and I think we're going to get there. And then the final chart for yields is the well-defined channel in which yields were ascending before they broke. That same channel can be overlaid to the dollar and to oil, and all three have broken. Ultimately, I think equities do the same thing.
So 4.195 is the next test on the 10-year Treasury yield to the downside, and then after that, we break 4 is your
thesis.
I think
so. Yep.
All right, let's now bring in the market watcher calling for gold to fuel a risk-on rally next year. Ben Emmons is senior portfolio manager, head of fixed income at New Edge Wealth. Carter, as you heard, is predicting decline in the S&P 500. But you're saying that that gold could actually be telling us that there could be a risk-on rally coming. Why is that?
Yeah, it's an interesting combo, Melissa. You know, normally you think of gold like a hedge against inflation or uncertainty. And I think both still play. I think that's one reason why gold is up. And to Guy's point, like yields are down, dollar's weaker. That's macro story for gold. But it's also a seasonal issue here. So we're in a really strong November month for stocks. It could be a good month for December too, at least that looks like it historically. Gold has an interesting pattern here too. It's actually doing even better than stocks in December, and specifically in years when the Fed is either easing or going towards a easing type bias. So I think we're in this stage here. This is why I think coming from the risk on part of the story, gold appreciates in value when there's uncertainty. It appreciates in value when there's risk on, when there is a apparent change of easing, of Fed policy towards the easing.
You had a note out this morning, and there's one little bit that sort of confused me, because you cited December outperformance of gold versus stocks by 2-1 since 2013.
Is it just the 2013? Because then you also say that in November, if the S&P rallies, then it's even then that's an even better sort of outcome. But we've only had one easing cycle, really.
True, and that is a shorter history. Uh-huh. But it is interesting to note that, though, that since that time, it's been very consistent every December being a pretty strong performance for gold, especially when there is a rally in the stock market in November. What's also interesting that in September, gold tends to get sold off over every single year that time, too. So I think this is what investors maybe are doing. It gets sold off in September, and we visit it again in November, December. So I think this seasonality plays a role.
Carter, I asked you a few weeks ago what you thought about the idea of seasonality, and you basically said that it was bunk. And so I'm curious what
sure.
you're looking at. Well, it, I can see the wheels
bunk,
turning.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about all this. I think, look, there are a lot of, there's this, for instance, you know, how does the stock market do in years, then in five? Guess what? It's up almost every time. But here we go. In 2025, would you put everything you have on the market because it goes up in the years five? Meaning, it's not to say numerology, and there is seasonality, but you can, at this point, get any data series to make any case one wants, right? And so I think there's a lot to being very mindful of data series. But one thing is this, that I think statistically you need something like 130 inputs to officially have something be statistically meaningful. And almost all data series in the stock market, 13 years out of 15, there's just not enough sample sets.
Right. Let's say the data is a good indicator. What is the fundamental story? Because it sounds like you're saying that gold right now is telling us a story of deflation, that's what is driving that story. And that notion of inflation coming down sharply is a good thing for the markets.
It is, because, you know, if you listen to Waller today, who was, I think, kind of extraordinary in his comments, he really started confirming what the Fed is moving towards to, right? We have a descending inflation, so the real rate is high, positive, and they could lower that nominal rate. I think that gives gold a bit, because ultimately that's the true story of I think, the gold rally in the past. You know, it is interesting to think about gold as this smile idea. So I was telling Carter before, you have the dollar smile, the dollar goes up when there's uncertainty and there's a strong economy. Similarly for gold, there's uncertainty next year. We have an election. We don't know what's going to happen. We get a recession, maybe not. So lots of uncertainty. So that probably is part of the other reason why gold is up. And at the same time, gold rallies when there's this risk on feel in the markets. And that's really when real rates and interest rates are declining. So I think this gives the gold, I think, a really good push for the breakout. So I'm with Guy and with Carter. It's likely going to break out to the upside.
Ben, good to see you. Thank you. Ben Emmons. Coming up, the China trade, big names heading in opposite directions as the country deals with a major outbreak. All the details ahead. You're watching Fast Money live from the Nasdaq market site in Times Square. Back right after this.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks closing in the green today. The Dow is up 83 points. The S&P up 0.1%. And the Nasdaq leading the gains up nearly 0.1% here as well. 0.3, I should say. In terms of stocks that have been moving today, payment stocks continuing to surge here. We got PayPal up 3.4%, Block up 5%, and Affirm up 11.5%. Those holiday numbers about how many people were using Buy Now, Pay Later services really helping there. And shares of CrowdStrike on the move after reporting its results. Shares are lower by 1.5% after the company posted a beat on the top and the bottom line. Coming up, all the headlines out of China, Alibaba and Pinduoduo diverging in today's session as the country faces a major outbreak. Our own Eunice Yoon is here.
Come on.
In the house with us for the first time since before the pandemic. Her take on how China has changed and the latest on the next outbreak. That's when he's back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. The U.S. listed ADR PDD Holdings surging more than 18% today. The parent company of Pinduoduo and Temu reported a 94% year-over-year revenue increase for its third quarter. Alibaba dropping today on the back of that news. This comes also as Chinese-founded fast fashion retailer Shein files to go public. To help us break it down, CNBC's Eunice Yun is here on set for the first time in 4 years. Eunice, welcome. It is a pleasure to see you in person, a pleasure to have you here on set.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Let's talk about this IPO and how it's impacting the others here. It's really interesting because it's really taken the U.S. by storm. Mm-hmm. It's a threat to other retailers, and yet it thrives on this sort of loophole in tariff land,
right,
where they can just ship directly to the consumer because it's worth so little, yeah, there are no taxes on it.
Right.
And so that's a huge part of the business model here.
Yeah, it is. And I think that what I think maybe people might find interesting about Shein over here is that in China, nobody knows about it, you know, from a consumer's perspective, because it's not Temu and Shein don't have any presence in China. But from a seller perspective, it's really seen as a really good way to sell to U.S. consumers. And especially with all the economic uncertainty, a lot of sellers are looking for that kind of opening.
So just thinking about how we saw Alibaba shares decline, the thinking is really that the sellers will sell on a Shein or a Temu instead of Alibaba. So it loses that part of the business as opposed to the sale because they're selling directly to Chinese
consumers. Well, I think that's part of it. But also PDD has been discounting so well and really kind of leading in that area of a lot of these bargain sales and Gen Z, too. The consumers are being seen as trying to strive for a bargain as opposed to striving to have like the best and most luxurious item. Like maybe you want to have secondhand LV bag or something like that, which wasn't really the case, you know, years ago. So it's just because the economic times are so negative right now that people are looking for different ways to save money.
So Eunice, since you've been gone, I don't know if you noticed this, but TikTok has come under a lot of regulatory scrutiny here in the U.S. So I wonder if these companies that are really selling into the U.S., and there's a whole host of things here, right? So now they have this consumer relationship. You know, TikTok was very different. It's about data. It's about, you know, user-generated content.
That's
now it's a financial transaction. I wonder, you know, as we start testing or they start testing the waters for U.S. investor appetite for these things, is regulatory going to be a big risk for some of these stories?
I think so. I mean, it's just that all of these companies, one of the things that they have in common is that they're Chinese companies or companies that had roots in China that are trying to play down the roots. Mm-hmm. Right. And so with Shein, I thought, OK, U.S. investors are going to want to know what the corporate governance is, how the structure is of this company. Because when you look at for Shein on or the founders and the people who are around Shein on Chinese databases, it's very murky, you know. So you could see that the founder, who's a guy who's named Sky or Chris Xu. So in China, he first was known as Sky, and after that, now I think he's going to be more of Chris overseas. But that you saw that he had a lot of different companies. They're kind of related to Shein, and then now some of the other executives are sort of related, but not really. And then there's a link to the Singaporean entity. So there's just all of this kind of, I guess it's like a lack of transparency over exactly how it's all linked together. I think that's something that they're going to look for. And then to your point about the customs of the parcels, like one of the big selling points for Shein is that instead of the traditional model of mass manufacturing and getting the prices down, what they're doing is they have these small batches and then they're able to sell into the U.S. market. And one of the ways that they're able to sell into the U.S. market is with these tiny under $800, you know, consignees. You don't actually have any documentation that you need.
Right.
So for customs, there isn't a lot of information then about who they're working with.
It's amazing. You can buy a $4.99 kids bathing suit and get it shipped from China in like a day.
Right.
You know this.
I have done that.
So she's heard.
I have done that. You mentioned the Economic Times. We all know that it's a very precarious time in China. Youth unemployment is very high, et cetera.
Yeah.
And now there's a health scare.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about the latest scare? Is it COVID related? Is it something completely different?
Well, right now, according to the Chinese health authorities and the WHO, there is no sign of a new pathogen. They don't say that it's COVID. It's just a mix of a lot of different pathogens, bacterial infections, viruses, such as RSV, that have been seen in other countries. So the WHO has said that this is something that you guys were seeing about a year ago, where there suddenly isn't as much masking and kids are getting sick because there just hasn't been as much exposure. So they're saying this is what we're seeing in China now. But because there has been such a trauma over the lockdowns and COVID there, and just the lack of transparency around it, probably overseas as well as domestically, there's just a lot of rumors about what is this? Is this another variant? Is this of COVID? Is this just something all new altogether? And it's not totally unjustified as to why there would be this skepticism.
Eunice, thank you. Great to see you. You'll be here all week, right?
I will.
Hopefully we'll see you again. Eunice Yoon. All right. Sneaky, sneaky small caps. We're diving into the Russell to drill down on two names that one of our traders says could be under the radar. Winners into year end. Plus, Tesla shares rallying today, even as production problems mount for the Cybertruck. We'll take a look under the hood of this EV stock next. Welcome back to Fast Money. Don't look now, but small caps could be primed for a breakout into year-end. The Russell 2000 has underperformed the larger indices this year, but after jumping 10% in the last month, one of our traders is picking out two names to keep an eye on. Julie, what names are you watching?
You know, I'm trying to think of, are we out of the woods yet, right? And I've wanted to kind of bug Carter about these charts. Fundamentally, I think both of these businesses are looking kind of interesting at this point. The first one is Moelis. Moelis is a boutique investment bank that's based in Los Angeles, started by star banker Ken Moelis. And his approach started right before the financial crisis, where in down periods, he would take that opportunity to hire the best bankers on the street. And, you know, he's created a real powerhouse. Obviously, right now with M&A very, very soft, it's been a challenging environment, but they don't tend to cut costs. They just ride through that and keep their talent over the long term. So I think for a long-term investor, this is interesting. The other one that I'm kind of curious about as far as is this out of the woods is Aspen Technology. This is a very high-quality software business. Some of its end markets in terms of understanding subsurface engineering have been a little bit softer. I love its digital grid management product set, though. That's growing very strong. I'm curious what Carter thinks as far as where are we with these charts.
Are these in your portfolio currently, Julie?
Yes, these are long-term holdings for us.
Okay, so Carter, your review of the charts, please.
Here we go, a little collaboration. So let's look at Moelis. It is a textbook example of a bearish to bullish reversal, a stock that dropped from 77 as low as 35 and is making the turn. The sequencing has changed, a series now of higher highs and higher lows. I like it a lot. Now, on the other hand, now Aspen, for me, is a pair of twos. You can see the volatility here, gapping up, gapping down. It must be saying things on a quarterly basis that no one can quite contend with. My hunch is to leave this one alone, neither be long nor short.
All right. Coming up, Tesla's precious cargo, the EV maker, will unveil its long-awaited Cybertruck at a special event this week. But is it worth the hype? Don't go anywhere. More Fast Money in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Tesla getting ready to unveil precious cargo, the EV maker holding its Cybertruck delivery event this Thursday. Manufacturing has been delayed several times. Elon is also set to go one-on-one tomorrow with our own Andrew Ross Sorkin at his Dealbook conference. Tesla shares are up this month, over 20%, in fact. This rise coming in the face of his recent controversy surrounding X and the wave of anti-Semitism on that social media site. A lot of questions to ask. So, Dan,
yeah.
What would you want to ask Elon Musk?
The kids call it the CT on the Twitter, okay? That's the Cybertruck.
Oh, okay.
I think the Cybertruck is going to be the new Coke of EV launches. I think it's going to be the Apple Newton of EV launches. I think it might be the Edsel of EV launches. Mm. And I'm just saying, the kids on the Twitter are like talking about the CT like it's going to transform the story. This is going to be the thing for 2024. So I just don't think it's going to be that thing.
And I mean, the manufacturing is going to be a beast, which he's talked about already on Twitter and in other venues. I mean, it's made out of stainless steel, which is much harder to shape and mold, apparently. Not that I have any experience personally with that, but versus regular commodity steel.
Yeah, DeLorean tried that. Didn't work out well. This is what I would ask him. This time last year, you said that margins would contract, but you wouldn't get down to legacy automaker margins, and it somewhere between 17 and 18%. Are you concerned with all the price cuts that it's going to eat into your margins? And if so, what are we looking at? That would be my question.
Quick take on the charts, Carter.
Yeah, well, Tesla kind of goes in the pair of twos category as
really?
Well. It's the same level it was essentially 3 years ago. A lot of volatility, but it's not really progressing. And then as to that truck, I think it's cool until one day you walk into your garage, you go, my God, that thing's ugly. And you never drive it again.
Up next, final trades. Welcome back to Fast Money. In case you're just tuning in, we want to let you know that Charlie Munger has died. He was Warren Buffett's right-hand man and the former Berkshire Hathaway vice chairman. Munger was just over a month away from his 100th birthday. CNBC will have continuing coverage on Munger's life and his massive impact on the investing world on Mad Money with Jim Cramer and later on as well on The Last Call at 7. Meantime, it's time for the final trade. Let's go around the horn. Julie Beal.
In the spirit of Charlie Munger, I tried to think of the highest quality business, and VRSK, Verisk, is probably one of them.
Carter.
Gold or silver or both. Precious metals.
Dan.
Yeah, I like Julie's Moelis call. This company had $5.40 in earnings in 2021. If the cycle turns, they're going to look really cheap in 2024.
Dan likes it. Guy.
It's first of all, it's great to have Eunice here, and we're saying she should be nominated and or win a Peabody Award. You think about from 2021, 22, incredible. It's great to have her here. Rest in peace, Mr. Munger, and again, condolences to everybody at Berkshire Hathaway and the family. Agnico Eagle Mines, AEM.
Thank you for watching Fast Money. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Fast Money Disclaimer.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.